has described, I suppose, the three strands of our activity. And I suppose the thinking behind the financial support piece was not just to kind of encourage good work within the system, but also to create real-life demonstrations of how this could be done and what it would be look like and what it would look like in an Irish context. So we've tried to distill that experience from 54 of what we call community living projects, and they've been supported by Genio since about 2010. They are 38 disability projects, 16 in mental health projects, with a total of 627 beneficiaries. What we've done is really combine data that we collect from on-site visits, both quantitative and qualitative, and supplemented that with more in-depth material from a sample of 23 projects that Roy evaluated and his colleagues, and he'll be talking about that in a little bit more detail. So these projects really, they took place in urban and rural settings in a variety of providers, large and small, HSE, Section 38, Section 39, so covered the whole range, and also covered, as you can see, the kind of range of needs that people might have. So looking down at the columns, these are figures from 2010 to 2012. There's almost 500 beneficiaries involved. And you can see that about a third of people with disability had a mild level of need. 41% were classified as having moderate needs and 26% with severe needs. And similarly in mental health, the proportions are slightly different, but about 40% with a mild level of need, 39% with a moderate level of need and 21% with a severe level of need. And we can get a bit more detail from Roy's study, where he was able to look again in more depth at a sample of beneficiaries. And again, there's a range of need represented there. People classified as having a need for high support, around a third, needing some support at 26% and 43% in the kind of low support category. But people also had additional needs. So about a fifth had epilepsy and a tenth had autism or autism spectrum disorder. So you can see that really there was a range of needs represented across these projects. So before I describe the main themes of the paper, I really wanted to just explore this key concept in a little bit more detail. When we started to describe these projects, we would talk about, you know, their aim was to support people to have independent lives in the community. And we found that people were interpreting that as meaning people had to live on their own, you know, go off and off you go, almost kind of no support. And of course, we were, you know, using that in the sense that I suppose we all would class ourselves as being kind of independent people. But really, are any of us truly independent? You know, we all rely on other people for lots of things in our everyday lives, from getting the groceries delivered to, you know, getting the computer fixed to, you know, help with children and so on. So really, we're all interdependent. We depend on other people. That's not a phrase that we use very often. So when you're trying to describe something in a way people can kind of get, interdependent living doesn't chime. So we were trying to be more precise about what we were trying to do and also really capture what that was about, the essence of it. And this is why we've started to describe this as supported self-directed living. And I suppose that concept is really getting to the key of probably what we do mean when we say independent. What we mean is that we're self-directed. We take charge of our own lives. I suppose that's the essence, really, of what we're talking about here. And it really does run through the rest of what I'm going to talk about. So the other reflection I had was this phrase that we use a lot, and everybody, and we certainly do, you know, which is put the person at the centre. But when I started to think about that, you know, we can still have the person at the centre, but, you know, not being self-directed, you know, having wraparound services and having no agency in their own lives. So I suppose to try and summarise that, the, you know, what seemed to be key to me is really a way of interacting with the person and a way of viewing the person that's really quite different. And again, this looks like lists of lots of kind of worthy phrases, but it's really quite profound in terms of when you start to implement this, it really changes things quite radically. So I think in our usual service delivery, the person is really a passive recipient of a service. They have no control, really, or no real say over what they get or what they don't get. We have had a model of kind of wraparound services. You often hear them described as cradle to grave, that promote dependency, that although we, you know, our espoused aim is for people to be independent, in fact, we're really not supporting that. And the person is viewed really as being dependent and a kind of a set of deficits that needs to be addressed in some way through a service. If we shift to think of supporting people to have self-directed lives, the person is self-determined, so they're the agent, and they may need support in making those decisions and in articulating those decisions, but they're really centrally involved in the design of what it is they get, their supports and services. And these are really tailored and targeted to promote self-directed living. And ultimately, it's the aim of we're looking for what we all are, which is a person, as a citizen, with abilities, interests, and contributions. And that really, I've heard people describe it as kind of activates what we do then and changes direction quite significantly. So in terms of implementing supported self-directed living, which in a sense was what these community projects were trying to do in looking at a specific aspect, it became clear to us in the learning that we were seeing was that it was occurring at really two levels. One was around the individual and this crystallisation of how we support people. And the other is things that organisations need to do, organisational level learning, if you like. And both are really important, but I'm really going to focus on organisational learning this morning. And what I'm presenting and the paper that you'll have to take home with you is not by any means a definitive guide as to how you do this or a step-by-step guide. It is a collection of insights and pointers, maybe things to avoid, that we have gleaned from these projects to really help move the process forward. And we've identified a number of what we call components for success. They're listed here. I'm not going to go through them all in detail this morning because we'd be here for a long time. I'm going to touch on a few. I'll talk about multi-level leadership. I have just spoken about the person leading the process, and that is central to this. How we involve families and other stakeholders, the importance of staff skills and training, this concept of readiness, I'll talk about it very briefly. It's about much more than housing if we want to do this really well, because we need to build strong and lasting relationships through linking with the person's community. It's really useful to start small and to model change. The challenge of reconfiguration is immense and not to be underestimated. So all of this does take time, but we do need to focus on outcomes and monitor progress to have a sense of moving forward. So just to touch on some of these, to just go back to that list, it's a long list, so I had to put it on two slides. These are, you know, there's nothing really very new here. If anybody's familiar with kind of change literature, this is all in the change literature. For us, what's new or what we've tried to do is move it from this kind of abstract list of concepts to how you implement, what this means in terms of implementation. So we all know, for example, leadership is really important. But what we have found is that it's not sufficient to rely on one charismatic leader in an organisation who's going to carry everybody and make it all happen. Really, what's been very effective is when there's multi-level leadership, so that leaders are identified at every level in the organisation and with people using services and families. And what you get effectively is a shared model of leadership, that everybody is not just buying into this, but is taking responsibility for what's within their remit, if you like. That's been really important. The enormous challenge to this is that there needs to be at least three streams of activity happening simultaneously. I think in the past, deinstitutionalisation programmes took a very linear approach and made a lot of assumptions about how we could best do this. And I'm drawing probably in Ireland on the experience on the mental health side, where you know, there was some preparation for people who were going to move from big institutions, but they were essentially moved then in groups to what effectively turned out to be smaller institutions in the community. So their physical surroundings were definitely much better, but really the quality of their life didn't change enormously. And the whole model and the cost stayed high as well. So in order to really kind of realise that vision of people having self-directed lives, identifying accommodation is really important and is a big challenge given the current housing shortage, I suppose. But the other really crucial piece is that at the same time, and identifying the accommodation really depends on getting to know the person really well and what accommodation is going to suit them. So it could be they want to live on their own, it could be they want to live with a friend, it could be they want to live with somebody who doesn't have a disability or a mental health difficulty or any any other combination. So it's not a good idea to kind of identify a bank of houses somewhere and say, okay, we'll slot everybody in there. And I think we need to learn from our own experience and from the experience of other jurisdictions who are saying that's not the best way to do this. The crucial piece in the mix is to not just support the person to move, but to really work hard at linking them with their community and building relationships. These individuals have been de-skilled from being in institutions for very many years and aren't, you know, we all find it hard to make friends when we move to a new area, so it's not just going to happen. So they need lots of intentional support to do that. And if, as if that wasn't enough activity to be getting on with, there is no big pot of money to support this process. So while that's going on, the organisation needs to be reconfiguring what it's doing so that it can provide the ongoing support when people have made that transition. So it is a really complex and challenging process, but I think we have a number of examples as to how this can happen on the ground. So how do we progress? Well, this starting small and modelling change is really important and a useful step. And what's important is not to stay at the small stages, to use that as a learning process. The individuals themselves, so it's manageable for an organisation to start with 1, 2, 3, 5 people. The place won't fall apart in the process. The individuals themselves act as role models for their peers. The staff act as role models for their peers. And everybody gets a sense that this is possible and this can work. we need to challenge the concept of readiness. You know, people say, well, who should we start with? Start with the people who are putting up their hands saying, I don't want to live here anymore. And, you know, the services that we've gone to, they have at least one person saying, I don't want to live here, I don't want to live here, I want to live somewhere else. So start with that person. And our concept of readiness is being challenged, I think, increasingly in the area of housing and in employment supports, where we, you know, the model was train people, get them ready for, and that process could go on for years. Whereas the new research evidence is saying, no, put the person in their home and put the supports in there that they need. It'll be very intensive at the beginning, but that will taper off. We need to involve families and allies in a really timely and respectful way. And individually, it's not helpful to call a room full of families together and say, we're closing our institution. That's not generally a helpful way to move the process forward. It's a one-on-one basis. Similarly, engaging with stakeholders, because nobody has a veto over this approach or over a person's right to have a self-directed life. We know that training for staff is key in this, because they are being challenged to work in a very different way, and that support is crucial. I think we all need to acknowledge that this takes time to do well. We could, you know, do it more quickly, but if we want to get the best outcomes for people, I think we need to acknowledge that it's going to take time. We still do need to keep a sense of urgency and moving forward. And moving at the pace of the person can sometimes be much faster than organisations expect. And finally, I suppose we need to just focus on the outcomes, keep our eye on the prize. What is it we're really aiming for here? Monitor the progress against that. Celebrate the small wins and the small gains and the steps towards that. But keep a sense of moving forward.